The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 11th, 2017. So, as promised, I'm announcing a new feature on the show, and I want you to be part of it. In what I'm hoping will be an interesting and somewhat novel idea, I'm requesting that you, the listeners, be my newscasters. Here's how it's going to work. Send me a message on our Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page, or send me an email at outspokencyclist@gmail.com. And tell me you would like to recount a news story. In turn, I will send you a link to a story that I would like you to report on in the upcoming episode, or you can let me know that you have a story you'd like to report about on the show. Then I'll call you, or we can use Skype. We'll record you reporting on the story, and we can take a few moments to discuss it. So here's an example of the type of reporting I mean. Earlier this week, I received the usual email about stories that were coming in, and this one was reported on BikeRadar.com by Josh Evans and Cycling News on March 9th. Shimano has said that it is investigating how as many as three of its wheels failed dramatically during the team time trial on the opening stage of Tirreno Adriatico. The incident saw Team Sky lose time and essentially drop out of the general classification battle. BMC's winning time was over 58 kilometers an hour for the 22.7-kilometer course. Gianni Moscone's spectacular crash following a front-wheel failure was one of the most memorable moments of the Stage 1. In the incident, the tubular tire became separated from the wheel and various pieces of carbon seemed to splinter off before total failure caused Moscone to come off of his bike. It was reported that the team had hit a series of potholes prior to the incident on the fast stage. Following the stage, where Team Sky conceded 1 minute 42 seconds to BMC, Geraint Thomas was reported as saying three of his teammates' wheels collapsed during the stage, although there is only footage of Moscone's front wheel failure. BMC Racing used the same pro wheels during the stage, so it is suspected that the incident is isolated, but Cycling News will update the investigation from Shimano as it continues. So see, you don't need any radio or podcast experience. You just have to be willing to offer up some thoughts about the story after you tell it and want to have some fun. Don't think about this too deeply. Just send me a note and we'll put it together. So now let's get on with the show for this week. When I received a press release about a pinball champion and a bike sponsorship, I had to scratch my head and say, huh. I'd heard about Detroit Bikes and knew a little about the company, but I wondered both how and why sponsoring a pinball champion fit into a marketing plan. After I read more, I became totally intrigued, and I think you will find the story fascinating. It isn't really about the sponsorship, although that's very real. It's about Zach Paschak, the president of Detroit Bikes, and his journey to becoming a bike manufacturer. Then we'll take our usual break and then come back and head out to Minnesota to talk with Mr. Strong Towns himself, Chuck Marone. Recently, Chuck spent some time in Shreveport, Louisiana, after learning about a highway that was slated to plow right through the Allendale neighborhood in Shreveport, using $90 million of their own money as their contribution to the $700 million federal project. But did anyone really get what this project would mean? Chuck started out thinking it wasn't worth the trip and ended up changing the thinking of many of those holding the purse strings. It's another great strong towns lesson. So let's head on up to the Motor City and talk with Zach Paschek from Detroit Bikes. Hi, Zach. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, so I want to know about Detroit Bikes, like who you are, what you do, and what the company does.
Sure. Where do you want to start?
Wherever you want to start. It's your company.
All right. I guess I'll briefly start with me and how I got into bikes. I'm from Canada originally, and I got into businesses in Canada when I was pretty young. I was in the music business, and when I was 23, I opened a music venue in Calgary, and then I opened another music venue in Vancouver a few years after that. The Calgary venue turned out to do pretty well, and so I wanted to expand, and then I eventually started a music festival in Calgary that became pretty big. I think it just had its 11th year, and through that, got really interested in communities, community building. I was interested in the music, but I was also just even more interested in organizing people and getting people together and kind of just changing the city a little bit. So after many years of sort of various interactions with different levels of government and, you know, having tried my hand at a few things and felt like I was successful, I decided I would run for city council in Calgary in 2010. And so through that, got really interested in transportation policy. I know you're wondering, how does this connect to bikes?
No, it's a fascinating story so far.
Good. So through reading about transportation policy and thinking about cities and how they're changing, it dawned on me that bicycles were going to be a big part of the future. So despite it being a 100-year-old technology or more, that I thought that, you know, over the next 30 or 40 years, we would see a really big expansion of urban cycling. And it basically comes down to space. As more people want to live in more densely populated areas, you just can't drive everywhere you want to go. So this sort of 1950s vision for the future of kind of everybody in a car all the time just wasn't really working, and cities were suffering because of it. And it seemed like there's a wave of people who wanted to see a different type of city, and I'm part of that. So my thought was, well, where is the bike industry kind of with this? And I didn't get into it because of a great history of being a cyclist or, you know, really knowing or loving the bike itself. I got into it from a public policy perspective, and I decided to go to a bike store to buy a bike to kind of do what I was talking about. And so instead of me driving to where I was going, I wanted to ride around the city, experience it, and get to know what that was like. And my experience in the bike store was just a little off-putting, I guess. It didn't seem like the bike industry really wanted me to be a cyclist. It seemed like I felt like I had to have a level of knowledge before the people at the bike store would really even, you know, acknowledge I was there, or, you know, I'd have to spend a bunch of money. And I don't think that's really the way things are right now. I'm not trying to knock all the bike stores, but it was just my initial experience. It just seemed like something was up a little bit, you know, but it was just an easier process to go buy a computer, you know, which is a really complicated machine, than it was to go buy a bike, which in theory should be a much simpler machine.
Wow, what a great perspective. Having owned a bike store for over 40 years, you know, and we tried to educate. Actually, we were always happy when a customer came in educated, but we were there to educate and to help a customer. And to have you come from that perspective into a bike shop and then immediately grasp what the problem is. Yeah, I think we need you in the bike industry.
Well, thank you for saying that.
You're welcome. So wait, let me ask you about city council first. Did you say, okay, screw that, I'm going to go back and do this bike thing?
No, I had a team kind of came together, and we ran a really good campaign. I got 9,000 votes. Unfortunately, the incumbent got 11,000, so he won. But I, you know, had learned a lot through that process, and I didn't really want to just wait around for the next election cycle. I wanted to kind of, you know, get moving and pushing, you know, my own beliefs forward. And so I thought, well, how can I, you know, given what I saw, how can I contribute to this? And so that sort of, as that strain was happening for me, I also became really interested in the city of Detroit. And just, so just from a public policy perspective, city of Detroit is incredibly fascinating. It is a city that has changed the world a few times over, for the good and for the bad in some cases. And it's got incredible beauty and incredible ugliness here. And just, you know, people are suffering, but also people are still, you know, innovating and developing incredible things. And so just a totally interesting place to me. I came to visit and fell in love with the place and, you know, the people here, the people who've stuck it out and who want to make the city better. And so there were just a lot of cool things happening here. And you know, there were other people kind of sniffing around at that time and wanting to move here and be part of it. And I met, you know, some great people. So I had sort of these two things running on in my head, which was, you know, one, I kind of want to keep pushing this urban agenda forward. And two, I want to figure out what I can do to contribute in Detroit. And so for me, Detroit, the situation in Detroit was, hey, this is a city where people need, you know, more jobs. There's people who are driving out to the suburbs for employment, and, you know, there's something just not right with that. And the best thing I can do to be a good citizen of my city here in Detroit is to create a company that can employ as many people as possible. So thinking about that, and then also thinking about, hey, also, so what can I do? What's a good business to get into? And then what have I noticed in my actual life as something that, well, maybe there's an opportunity for somebody. And for me, it was bikes. You know, I just sort of put it together that, you know, maybe there are other people like me who just really are interested in cities and want to get into riding a bike because it's a cleaner, healthier way to get around a city. And so maybe they're going to care about the backstory of where they get their products from, and they're going to like that it, you know, that it's also coming from, you know, a place that's directly impacting a rebuilding city, because, you know, they're actually made, you know, here in the U.S. in Detroit. So I thought if I could find a way to put those together, it would be a really compelling story and might get people kind of interested in the company and at least get them to, you know, hop on a bike and give it a ride, you know, a test ride or something. So I thought that would be a good way to open the door, and just kind of had a bunch of kind of things come together, and it seemed like, hey, that, you know, that actually could work. Let's give this a shot.
When did you actually open the company Detroit Bikes?
So because I'm a Canadian citizen, I couldn't just move to Detroit. I had to have the company started first and then move sort of to come and employ myself in the company. So the company actually started really early. It started in 2011, and I spent 2 years researching bikes, talking to as many people as I could. Amy Walker was really helpful at this time. She was in Vancouver and started what's the big bike magazine?
It's Momentum.
Momentum.
Yeah, no, I know Amy. I've spoken with her. Yeah, she's a really cool person, actually.
She is so cool and was so helpful to me, just kind of getting my head clear about what, you know, what could be a really impactful way to approach the industry. And so just, you know, talk to people like her and other people I knew, friends of mine and people I met down here as well, and just worked on this concept of trying to figure out, how can we make a bike that has as limited maintenance for people as possible and kind of removes as much of the confusion or complexity as possible? And then while that was happening, I also had to, you know, because it's a whole new industry for me, I had to start to learn, you know, how do you build a factory? How do you find people who know how to build a factory? What is, you know, what do you do inside of a factory? How do you actually make a bike? And so it was definitely a lot of research and a lot of learning. And then it's identifying those people. But that's kind of the one of the great gifts of moving to Detroit, among many, was just that there are just a lot of really smart people here. And so my job wasn't really, you know, how do I strap this thing onto my shoulders and do it all? It was, how do I organize a team that knows how to do this, and how do I sift through who's going to contribute to that team well and who isn't? And that's something that I'd had a lot of experience in anyways, so kind of made it more manageable. And so then, you know, 2013, bought the factory. Took about a year to build out the, you know, the equipment and processes. And, you know, truth be told, we're still kind of refining processes and kind of constantly getting better. Pumped the first bikes out into the market in October of 2013. And we've just sort of been off to the races since then, trying to figure out what bike shops want us to make, what they think they can sell. And then also trying to marry that to what we think consumers want ultimately. What our original vision, my original vision, and the people, you know, the company's original vision was for what we were going to do. Just trying to navigate that and then, you know, figure out how to get the bigger contract sales that we need to survive while we kind of get our brand, something that, you know, the bike industry is familiar with and supportive of.
Let me ask you a question, if you don't mind answering. How old are you?
gosh, how old am I now? Almost 37, 36.
Okay. So you really are a young man. You are doing some amazing things. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Zach Paschak. I hope I said that correctly.
That'll work.
Oh, well, if it's not, you need to correct it.
I don't know how to pronounce it.
Oh, well,
Paschak, Paschak.
Oh, okay.
I get a few different ones.
Okay, we're talking with Zach. He is the are you technically the president of Detroit Bikes?
Yes.
Okay. It's been on my radar for a while, the company and what you're doing. So before we get on to the crazy email that you sent me about this interesting sponsorship that you wrote me back and said, got one, I'd like to know a little bit about the bikes themselves. So you basically make, it looks like, a couple of models, an A and a B, maybe?
Yeah, the first bike we did was the A type, and then we followed that up with the B and then the C, and then now we've added a couple more types as well. We've got a Cortello that's coming out this spring, which is like a hybrid, kind of a flat bar road bike. But yeah, the bikes are just meant to be very simple, very accessible, bikes that are going to make you want to ride a bike every day, basically. So instead of being worried about locking it up downtown or, you know, feeling like you need to have a great degree of knowledge before you, you know, even kind of dip your foot in the world of cycling, I wanted to make like basically like a grocery store bike, but that was going to hold up. So I like to compare it to cars sometimes. So I don't think this is true anymore, but when I first started looking at bikes, it sort of seemed like you kind of were able to choose between Ladas or Lamborghinis, basically. You had bikes that you'd buy at a big box store that people did not really care about whether or not that bike was going to work for you. And sometimes they do work. Sometimes they work really well. But, you know, a lot of the time, that's not what's driving the decision-making behind the design and spec on those bikes. And then on the other hand, you had bikes that were just way beyond what most people needed because they were sort of more being driven from a racing mentality. So you were seeing bikes that cost, you know, a lot of money that you'd be pretty nervous about leaving, you know, outside of a bar or something. And there was sort of pressure to put you into that camp. Like, you know, you were part of a process of graduating into being someone who rode a bike like that. And so what I was trying to do was say, hey, why don't we try to focus on like maybe the Honda Civic of bikes? Like, let's make a bike that finds that perfect intersection of quality and affordability. We're not going to sacrifice quality. We're going to put the parts on that we think it needs, but we're not going to ever put a part on that takes away from the affordability of the bike.
You aren't manufacturing directly to the consumer. You are manufacturing to the bike shop. That's what I thought I heard.
So we're a manufacturer. We have the biggest bike frame factory in the United States, 50,000 square feet. We have the capacity to make, I think, you know, we haven't reached our height of capacity, but I think we could make 50,000 frames a year out of that building, out of that facility. So the bikes that we make range from, you know, between $599 and, you know, $800 roughly.
Okay. I guess, and I've seen them, I like the design. I like the actual physical design of the frame. They are all steel bikes. They are TIG welded, I take it?
Yeah, they're all TIG welded chromoly, U.S. sourced chromoly.
And powder coated?
Yes, we powder coat in-house as well.
So everything is sourced and made here in the States?
Well, everything on the frame.
Right.
The parts are still coming from overseas. And that's going to change soon, too. So we're going to be announcing, I guess this is breaking news, but...
Ooh, good.
We haven't announced it yet, but we're going to be offering another tier of production. So basically, making everything in the States tends to be pretty expensive. We've been able to drive that price pretty low just because of the way that we're producing. We're doing more sort of high-volume production, so it helps keep our costs down. Nonetheless, it's still a little bit of a stretch for most consumers, so we're going to also be offering bikes with Chinese-made frames that are still assembled in the U.S., and we'll just be very clear about what the difference is. So instead of forcing customers to have to buy a U.S.-made frame if they don't want to, we're just going to give that option. So we'll always have it available for people, but it won't be your only choice from Detroit Bikes.
If I were a dealer who wasn't carrying one of the big brands, Specialized Trek, like that, and was looking to have a house type brand, are you branding these bikes beside Detroit Bikes? Do they have a shop name or do you do contract work, I guess is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, and that's where we've had the most success actually, is contract work for smaller contracts, because As I'm sure you know, most of the bikes in the United States, like 99.9%, are coming from overseas. So you don't really have an option to call up a brand and say, hey, can you make me 10 with my store name on it? Because they're not going to go to their factory in China and say, hey, can you do a special run of 10? The factory's going to say, no, we can't. Whereas for us, it's a lot easier because we're actually making the bikes here. We can do a run of 10, and it's pretty easy to turn around because we just paint them a different color and order a decal set with whatever you want on it. So if you're using a frame that's similar to a frame we're already making, then it's really easy for us to do custom runs. If you want a whole custom frame, we can still do that too, but it's, you know, there's engineering and testing and tooling charges, so you need to buy a bit higher volume. We usually say our minimum is 500 if you're doing a custom frame design, but our minimum is only 10 if you want a custom run of, like, custom branded bikes.
So if somebody were to send you a drawing and said, this is what I want you to build, that takes it into the realm of you need 500. Or we go to your ABC bikes and say, I want 5 of each or 10 of each and come up, ship me 30 bikes.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I understand. We're going to take a real quick break and we're going to come back to talk about Zach and a guy named Robert Gagnon. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are speaking with Zach Paschek up at Detroit Bikes. And the reason I contacted you when I did was because of a press release you sent me about Detroit Bikes sponsoring the Pinball Champion. So I'm trying to put together, all right, what the hell does pinball have to do with cycling? And you're going to tell me why.
Oh, I could spin this a number of different ways.
Oh, go ahead.
Let me just have fun with this one.
Absolutely.
So one of the ways that I think a salesperson could sell Detroit Bike effectively, if someone walked into a bike store, you could say, well, hey, do you want to see something a little different? And that's what we are. We're kind of an outlier. It's a different approach to the industry. It's a different type of company. And, you know, you kind of see that in the product. So here's, for a different type of company, this is a different type of sponsorship. This is, you know, a company has a few different ways to market itself, and these things cost different amounts of money. So I could buy a bunch of ads on Google. I could try to buy radio spots or, you know, buy a magazine ad. Another option open to companies is that they can sponsor, you know, people who they choose to. So for a long time, I've been thinking of sponsoring Kobayashi, who's the world hot dog eating champion.
Wait, the world what?
Hot dog eating champion.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
He just seems like a really cool guy, you know?
The question is, can he get his butt up on a bike?
Well, he's actually pretty thin.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, when I think about that, yeah.
But so then, you know, I hadn't pursued that, actually. But then Robert came along, and a friend of mine is a really brilliant journalist who writes long-form articles. And he wrote a portrait of Robert for ESPN Magazine, which I read, and I was just really touched by it. And then my friend tells me about sort of continued meeting with Robert. They both live in Vancouver. And Robert just seems like a really great young guy. You know, he's got certain challenges in life, and he overcomes them and just seems cool. So, you know, I have an opportunity. I run a company. It's not totally out of the realm of reasonability to sponsor, you know, a person. And so why not do what speaks to me? And in this case, that speaks to me, and I know it's a little different, but I kind of like being able to make that statement too. You know, you wouldn't see Trek ever sponsor the world's best pinball player, you know, and we're different, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we don't need to try to emulate what other companies are doing. So,
I want you to tell people a little bit about Robert. I read the ESPN story; it is touching. Just give us your take on Robert and some of the challenges he faces, and then I want to know about what bike you got him.
So, you know, I don't like to speak to people's, you know, diagnoses or conditions, but that, you know, that is a factor, I guess, for Robert, is that he's been diagnosed as someone who has autism, is on the autism spectrum, and so that, you know, the story sort of touches on that. It's sort of a popular topic these days, and sort of, you know, something that a lot of people are aware of and thinking about. And, you know, I don't really like to necessarily define people by that. That's why I removed it actually from the press release, any real mention of it. But, and, you know, so forget that, but it happens to be part of it. But just like any, you know, young person, he faces different challenges. We all have different challenges. And he, you know, what he's done with it, you know, he's gone out and followed, you know, I guess a hobby, but become actually the best in the world at it. He also, you know, practices, like, you know, circus type tricks, and he rides his bike, and he goes and joins like poker tournaments and wins them. And, you know, just seems like, just a pretty special guy. And, so something kind of cool too. I mean, this might seem callous, but also he's actually getting a lot of attention. HBO is going to be filming a sort of feature on him. And then there's also this documentary being made about him right now. And so, you know, the sponsorship for Detroit Bikes, it's actually just like on paper, a pretty effective sponsorship too, because, you know, Robert, because he's so successful, is getting a lot of exposure, and it actually is a pretty kind of great stealthy, you know, brand placement, because it, like I said earlier, you know, kind of speaks to how we're a bit of a different company, and he actually is getting a lot of exposure. So it, you know, type of thing that maybe seems kind of goofy or scoffable at first, but, you know, if you see it through, it's not totally.
I think it's awesome what you're saying about Robert being special, but he really, we're all special. So for him, you know, for you to be able to take somewhat, and I don't want to say advantage, but take advantage of the opportunity to have him on your team, I think it's really cool. I know nothing about pinball. I mean, absolutely nothing. But I saw some of the photographs in your friend's ESPN story. And I mean, we're talking massive crowds watching this stuff. This is like gaming, you know?
Well, I think people are interested in alternative kind of sports now. You know, there's just so much bombardment of kind of the pro sports, and people like the competition and, you know, the storylines that come out of sports. But I think there's an interest in finding, you know, different types of things to cheer for. And, you know, that's driving some people to be interested in pinball. But yeah, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this is it's a business transaction for Robert. It's nice to be sponsored, and he's got a cool bike, and his dad got a cool bike, and, you know, some other stuff. And for us, you know, we get good exposure. So there's the personal side that I really like. But then, you know, on the other side, it's a practical relationship as well, and there's nothing wrong with that.
What kind of bike did he get?
He got the A-Type, and then his dad got the C-Type.
How cool
and
is that?
The A-Type, yeah, we've done for years I've been trying to get the bend of the top tube of the A-Type right. The first prototype we did had this beautiful arc to that top tube, and then when we got the equipment in to do the bend, it didn't have a long enough radius, so the bend had a bit of like a slight kind of kink in it. Didn't look as beautiful as I wanted the original one to. So we finally got that down. We finally bought a tube bending machine that can do it. And so it's just got this beautiful bend. So I really wanted him to have the new version of the A-Type, just because that's sort of, I hope that forever that will be Detroit Bike's kind of signature bike. It's sort of ubiquitous with the company. So I wanted him to have that. And then for his dad, got him what I think is maybe the most purely kind of beautiful bike we make, which is the C-Type in slate with the chrome fork, and I thought he might just get a kick out of that, and kind of cool for the two of them to be able to go for rides together.
Well, that A bend, that elegant arc, is really very beautiful. When you look at it on the side, I like that bike right away as soon as I saw it. And then you have the sort of Dutch version of it evidently you're assuming that's for a woman, or are you just saying that for people who don't want the top tube?
Yeah, I've tried to remove the gender.
Good. Okay.
But I just call it a step two. But so basically, traditionally, it's, you know, more for women, I guess, and so you can wear a dress. But who's wearing a dress riding a bike now? Anyways, so it's more really just for people who just don't want to kind of lift up their entire leg to step over the bike and want an easier time getting on and off of the thing.
Well, let me ask you a weird question. How is business?
Business is very hard and pretty exciting and pretty good, too. It's been a lot harder to crack into the retail channel than I thought it would be. I expected that there would be people just buzzing about this company with excitement because an affordable bike made in the U.S. was back. And I'd heard so many shops tell me that they really just would love that. The customers would love that. And so I thought, you know, wow, this thing is going to blow up when I finally release these. And then, you know, right off the bat, I was met with a lot of skepticism and a lot of, criticism, which is fair. And in hindsight, it totally makes sense. I mean, who was I to think that with a group of people who have no experience manufacturing bikes, we're going to go out there and blow people away? Now, I realize that it's not just that it's made in the U.S. It also has to be better because it's made here. Like, you know, it's not enough just to make a bike in the U.S. and have it at a good price point. It's got to be a kick-ass bike. So it's taken us some time to get there. But we're starting to get traction now, and, you know, this plan of kind of the two tiers of manufacturing, I think, is going to be really effective for us to always have that ability to make the U.S. frame for those who want it, but also to be able to compete on price point with any other company out there. And then there's the contract stuff, which has been growing for us. So we have that huge contract, 2,500 bikes with New Belgium Brewery, who were our first big partnership and a company that just took a risk on us. It was the biggest order we'd ever had. Awesome company, really, really a great group of people. And so we made those bikes for them. We're doing an order again for them this year. And then that kind of spiraled into us doing the bike share bikes for the Brooklyn expansion of Motivates program, which I heard your show with Ben Serrata the other day. So that's where there was some crossover. He was involved with them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we're working on hopefully some other bike share opportunities. So where the retail side kind of had, you know, it's been sort of slower than I initially dreamt it would be. The fact that we tooled up to get ready for broader acceptance allowed us to get these contracts because we're kind of the only place that has this capacity in the U.S. and has this kind of, you know, institutional knowledge in terms of, you know, really knowing how to build wheels and having a good wheel building machine, having good, you know, parts buyers and suppliers and having good engineers and welding and et cetera. So we've just got a toolkit now because of that allows us to be, you know, kind of, I don't want to even say competitive because there's not really any other options for people, but allows us to provide services to certain companies that need them, you know, because we built out this capacity with the thought we'd be manufacturing our own brand.
Has anybody come to you and said, I want to open a bike shop and I want to feature Detroit bikes. I don't want to carry anything else?
We've had a couple, yeah. I think they've both been in Canada, oddly.
Huh. No, somehow that doesn't surprise me, but I think it's kind of an interesting idea because you can build, you know, sort of a brand around a brand, and that would be kind of cool. It would be like your own brand. So XYZ Bike Shop, and that's all you carry is XYZ bikes. That would be really cool, I think. I like that, actually.
Yeah, and if they could tell, you know, if their customers thought the story of where XYZ Bikes came from was cool, they could tell that story too. And I'd love that. You know, it'd be cool too if they had a few shops. You know, it doesn't. I don't know. I'm going too far down the path.
That's true. So I'm going to end with my usual questions. What's your favorite food?
Oh, I'm going to say lasagna.
Really? Wow. Nice. And what kind of music do you like to listen to?
I listen to a lot of classical music lately. I've got 90.9 here in my car. I drive to and from work, so that's been nice.
Nice. And do you have any pets?
I do. I've got a beautiful Belgian Malinois dog.
Nice.
She's just about to turn 2. She keeps my house nice and safe. She's a very good guard dog.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're beautiful. A lot of people, I think, mistake them for shepherds, German shepherds.
Yes.
And they are not. Well, Zach, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. I wish you a lot of luck. We are not far from you. We're only about 3 hours from you. Maybe we'll make a little trip up there one day and take a look at the facility. I'd really like that.
And your listeners are all welcome, too. We do factory tours, so love to show anybody around. And I appreciate your time, Dan. Thank you.
All right. Well, give them your website, and then we will let you get back to work.
Thanks so much. Okay. The website is www.detroitbikes.com.
All right, Zach Paschak, the president of Detroit Bikes, obviously in Detroit, Michigan, making bikes here in the U.S. I'm really excited. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All righty. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Zach Paschak, president of Detroit Bikes, joined me from Detroit, Michigan. I thought this conversation was going to be about bicycles, pinball, and his sponsorship of the young man, Robert Gagneau. But obviously, it was much more in-depth, very interesting. I learned a lot, and I really like his approach to the bicycle business. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. on the Outspoken Cyclist. We are going to head on out to Minnesota to catch up with Mr. Strong Towns himself, Chuck Marone. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I should say welcome back. It's been a long time since we spoke, almost 2 years.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back on the show. I appreciate it.
As we were chatting before we started recording our conversation, I often quote things that Strong Towns says. Your commentary comes through in my email. But one headline really caught my attention recently, and I really wanted to talk with you. So it was exactly, what would your neighborhood do with $90 million? I thought, well, that's a good thing for a neighborhood, until I realized what was going on. Tell us a little bit about the background on that, and then at some point I want to talk about what the new administration may or may not really do.
Right. I get to travel all over and speak to audiences all over the country. And one of the places I was invited last year was the city of Shreveport in Louisiana. And I have to be frank, it was a long week. I was traveling in the Northwest and had to take this just really bad flight. And they got there and they screwed up my bags and I was grouchy and I didn't want to be there. And I thought, why am I in Shreveport Saturday at the end of this long week? And then I got to start talking to people, and oh my gosh, my eyes were just really opened, and I was kind of blown away. These projects that you think happened in the 50s and 60s, where we went through the poorest neighborhood in town with a freeway and, you know, kicked people out and ripped down their homes and ran these destructive freeways through the middle of the city, you think that we're done doing that. We don't do that anymore. But here I found myself in this neighborhood in Shreveport, largely African-American, very poor neighborhood, but a place where the people had a lot of spirit and a lot of love for their place and were doing a lot of really great things on the ground. But they had this sword of Damocles hanging over their head, this $700 million federally funded highway project that the city and the region was pushing that was going to run right through the heart of their neighborhood. And they were doing everything they could to try to fight it. But it's, you know, it's the ultimate David and Goliath kind of thing. And I was really moved by it. And so we decided that we were going to do an entire week trying to highlight their story and just let people know that, you know, this kind of thing still is happening. And, you know, communities like this need our help and need our support.
So what kinds of things can a small community of people who don't have a lot of resources do to fight something like this? I mean, that's a huge number. And then there's the $90 million. What's the $90 million to?
Yeah, the $90 million is actually the local contribution. So the idea is that the federal government would pay for the bulk of this, but then, you know, you got to have a little bit of local skin in the game. So locally, they'd have to come up with $90 million. Which is a huge sum of money. It's an enormous sum of money. And when you look at this neighborhood and you look at Shreveport in general, there are people in this city doing miraculous things, just everything from redoing this great art gallery that they had to doing some street art to fixing up some crosswalks and different things. They're doing this great stuff in Shreveport, and they're doing it on like nickels and dimes. And the question kind of that we put out was, okay, instead of, you know, using this $90 million, you're just going to kind of throw away in what is a really low returning investment for the community. What if you actually took that and tried to double down or, you know, 10x really the smaller efforts that other people were doing successfully in your community? What would you have then? What would that do to quality of life? What would that do to the return on investment? What would that do to the wealth that was being built in the community? And obviously, it would be overwhelming.
So how can they take that $90 million? I mean, would it be taken off the table if the project went away, number one? And number two, how do you fight a project that already seems to be, you know, what they call shovel ready?
Yeah. The saddest part of it is that, you know, in times when the money flows from the federal level, what they do is they tend to look for these shovel ready projects. And, you know, I'm an engineer. I understand what a shovel-ready project is. A shovel-ready project is essentially a project that has gotten through all of the design and everything, and you just get to the end, and nobody thinks it's a very good enough project to pay for. So it goes on a shelf. It sits there. It's a bad project. And then, you know, once we get either an infusion of money for economic development purposes or because we're going to make America great or whatever the rationale is for, you know, dispensing money from Washington, D.C., they go run around and look for these shovel-ready projects. And so we wind up funding, like, the worst of the worst. The $90 million is the city's part. It's the city's ante to get the rest of, you know, the 600-some million from the feds. And so, you know, if the project didn't go forward, the city wouldn't spend that money. And, you know, they could save it if they wanted to. That might be a good thing to do. What we tried to put forward is basically an apples-to-apples comparison to them. Like, okay, if you want to spend it on this highway, you're not going to get very much for that investment. In fact, you're going to get a lot of negative things from that investment. But if you really are intent on spending $90 million to make the community better, well, there's a lot of things that you could do that would, you know, be very low risk and very high returning and really improve quality of people's lives in your community.
And what happened?
We're still in the process. It's interesting because, you know, I gave a series of lectures when I was there and then did some meetings with a whole bunch of different groups, from elected officials down to neighborhood activist groups. I did a walking tour through a bunch of different neighborhoods, and we looked at them and talked about them. I'm really proud of the fact that that dialogue had a big impact on them. And even before we started doing our piece, you know, the stuff on our site where we really took a deep look at it, the conversation there is already starting to shift. They have this group called the Council of 100, and it just sounds like the Illuminati. It's a group of like chamber members and business leaders and you know, all the highly connected people, and they're kind of came together to support this project and push it ahead. That's a Goliath kind of group that David is going up against. The interesting thing is that since we went to town and did the engagement, and then kind of again with the media stuff we shared, there's a lot of defectors now in that group. There's a lot of people standing up in that group saying, hey, I didn't really think about it in this way, and maybe we should be doing something different. So I'm hopeful, and we're not going to claim credit for this. I mean, the people in this neighborhood group have done so much work to make this very real for people. And really, you know, step up and show that they can do some great things in their neighborhood if they get this sort of Damocles off of them. There is some shift there locally, and I'm hoping that the momentum for that continues.
Well, I guess I think about $700 million being spent by the federal government to put a highway directly through a residential neighborhood. It just doesn't compute for me. I don't understand what the rationale is to not do what other cities do, and that is you sort of take it around neighborhoods if you need to do another highway, which most people don't anyway.
Let me give you their rationale, the project rationale, because it's very, you know, this is kind of an extreme circumstance, but it rhymes with what we do in states all over the country. I mean, this is a very common kind of mindset. The first rationale is that, you know, they are going around the city. You know, this is the edge of town. It's not one of the core neighborhoods. The highway right now goes through the core neighborhoods. And so for them, this is essentially like a little bypass. There's another alternative called the loop that would go 14 miles out of the way. This is a 3-mile loop, the one that is being proposed. And, you know, from a project advocacy standpoint, they look at this neighborhood and say, this is cheap land. This is not real well developed. And if we run this highway through, we'll put in some interchanges and we'll get a lot of investment here. We'll get Walmart and a McDonald's and a bunch of strip malls, and we'll get some residential development. And that will help because this neighborhood is underserved right now and underdeveloped. And, you know, the rationale is we'll save people a little bit of time, too. If you're driving from Louisiana up to Canada carrying freight, we're going to save you, you know, 2.5 minutes going through Shreveport by being able to cruise around to the west a little bit. And so that's going to be good for you and good for America and good for freight travel. And, you know, basically that's the rationale right there. That is the entire reason we're going to spend you know, we propose to spend $700 million.
Unbelievable. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chuck Marone. He is Mr. Strong Towns. We have spoken with him in the past, and he has such an interesting perspective on what strong towns really should look like and are looking like more. I think there are more people beginning to look at infrastructure differently, and I do want to talk about that, and that is what kind of things you think infrastructure is going to look like. Are we going to be seeing just more roads, bridges, the same old, or are people thinking a little more about the livable communities that you and I talk about and hope for in the future?
I think a lot of it's going to depend on where the money originates from. You know, we're having this national dialogue right now about an infrastructure surge. And with all the partisanship that we have at the federal level, the one thing we seemingly agree on, not me, but the people there embroiled in this, is that we need to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. And when the money comes out of Washington, D.C. for projects like this, they tend to be, it's very hard at the federal level to work fine grain. They tend to be very big projects. I mean, a small federal project is a $40 or $50 million project. In a neighborhood, that's a massive, I mean, that's an overwhelming project. So it depends on where the money originates from. As long as we're going to keep pouring money in at the federal level, we're going to get these big top-down, build it and they will come type of projects that tend to, you know, run over neighborhoods and, you know, leave a lot of destruction in their wake and a very little return on those investments. When we can have money spent at the very local level and have mayors and city councils and community activist groups and others involved at the block level kind of direct what the important projects are, what we see is that we get a lot more projects. They're a lot smaller. They're a lot less risky. So, you know, if the things don't work out, you're not losing a ton of money. You learn from that and try something else. But most importantly, what we're seeing is that these are the highest returning investments that we can make. When we work at the very small level, putting in street trees, sidewalks, narrowing up streets, reconnecting neighborhoods with their core downtowns, with each other, you know, improving in small ways, local transit operations and things like that, what we find is that those are very low-risk, high-return investments. They're also really hard to do with federal money, really hard. The future of successful cities are going to be the ones that can really kind of shift their mentality, not you know, away from chasing grants and trying to get the big project and towards kind of taking care of these fine-grained details in their own communities.
What do you say to the concept of we need jobs, that infrastructure will create jobs? Now, I understand building a bike path, for example, is a bigger ROI, return on investment, as far as jobs per mile. But how do you counter the idea that, well, if we put this huge infrastructure program in place, we're going to have millions of people working, and we're going to have local steel, and we're going to have local concrete, and we're going to have all of that, and it'll, quote unquote, as you said, make America great again. We won't get into that.
Right. No, I get the economic theories. I mean, you can go back to the Great Depression, and there is this notion that if, you know, you pay people to dig a ditch and fill it back in, you've created a job, and that's better than having someone sit idle. Whether you buy that theory or not, that's not what infrastructure spending is. Infrastructure spending is, you know, we pay someone to build a bridge, and then now we forever must maintain a bridge. And a lot of the building happens with federal dollars. Most of the maintaining happens with local dollars. And so what we see is that two generations of following this mindset, every time we needed to juice the economy a little bit, we would just spend a lot more on infrastructure. What we see is that our cities are overwhelmed with liabilities and don't have anywhere near the wealth or the cash flow to maintain everything that has been built. We just don't make very productive use of it. What we say at Strong Towns is that jobs are the byproduct of a healthy economy, not the cause of one. And what we're really trying to say is when we focus on job creation as the end goal, From a federal policy standpoint, what we wind up with is very short-term job creation and then long-term stagnation and decline. If instead we focus on the fine grain, making our cities stronger financially, making them financially healthier, helping them make better investments, what we find is that that act in itself creates a lot of jobs. I mean, if you're maintaining the street, that requires people to come in and do that work just as much as building a brand new bridge somewhere does. But you also create this platform where more jobs are created at the local level, and not only more jobs, but jobs that are more resilient, jobs that last, that are less volatile, that are more tied into a local economic ecosystem, as opposed to being part of some, you know, Wall Street corporate distant ownership structure. What we really want at the end of the day are stable, well-paying, local ecosystem kind of jobs. And we don't create those with these big mega projects. We create short-term sugar highs is what we do economically, and we've got to get away from that.
Such interesting topic. You know, we discuss it a lot on the show, and we talk about the economic benefits of slowing down traffic, narrowing streets, all of those things. And somehow it seems to escape. As soon as it gets out of the city, it escapes into the atmosphere somewhere and nobody else is listening. I know that's not true. It is changing. So one of the things that Strong Towns does is it has a Strongest Town contest. Tell us about your contest for 2017.
It's so much fun. We decided a couple years ago that we wanted to do something really, really positive. Every now and then at Strong Towns, we tend to point out, you know, things that aren't going right and try to kind of wake people up and help them see, like, these are bad practices. It's a little bit like telling people, you know, those potato chips you're eating, not so good. But it's helpful to show people, like, okay, here's a healthy diet. Like, here's someone doing this really well, and look at how successful they are, and you can do this too. And so for cities, we came up with the Strongest Town contest. Let's take a look at places around the country. Let's have our members and parts of our audience come forward and say, I'd like you to take a look at my place, and let's look at all the positive things that are going on there. None of these places are perfect. None of these places do everything right. But they're doing a lot of things that we should be applauding, and we should be learning from, and we should be, you know, holding up for people to see as a model. And so we start with 16 cities, and we have, 4 weeks of voting. The first week, we ask them to submit some information, answer some questions about their community. We take that from 16 to 8 then, and we're now at 8. That's where we're at. Next week, we're going to send them a list of images we'd like them to take in their community, photos we'd like them to go out and shoot. And we will then post those and compare them and get that list down to 4. We're then going to do some interviews with people on a podcast and have them in their own words talk about their community. And then the end, we do a video interview with the final two and wind up naming the strongest town in America at some point towards the end of March. And then I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there, and we're going to have a kind of a strongest town party, and it'll be a good time.
That sounds like a lot of fun. You mentioned the word podcast. It seems like everybody's doing podcasts now. I mean, this one is now almost seven years old, and I feel like the old lady on the block anymore. It's so cool that everybody's getting into podcasting. How often are you making podcasts or recording podcasts?
I think we're up to somewhere around episode 400. We've been doing it too since about 2011. I want to say is when I started.
Wow!
It used to be once a week. And now we're doing 2 or 3 a week. We try to mix the format up. So we do a kind of an insider's podcast where we talk about the stuff going on here. And then once a week, I try to do an interview or a monologue podcast. And now this year, we've added this thing called Strong Talk, which is kind of like a roundtable thing we do as a video. And then also release it as an audio podcast, too. So that's been fun. We try to reach as many people as we can in as many different forums and vehicles as we can use. And podcasting has been a great one. You know, I travel around and people come up to me and say, oh, you sound just like you do on the podcast.
Yeah, I've had people walk up to me and say, are you Diane? I'm like, yes. And they say, yeah. Oh, I recognize your voice from your show.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Strong Towns has come a long way. You've done some great work, and it's really a pleasure to be able to talk with you again. Tell our listeners how they can get involved with Strong Towns, your organization, and then learn something to take back to their town.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We're publishing 2-3 times a day at strongtowns.org. You can go there. All of our stuff is Creative Commons licensed, which means we release it for everybody to use as best they can in their communities. There's no licensing stuff to reprint our stuff or to share it with others. So please go to strongtowns.org. Anything you find helpful in your local dialogue, please use it to do good.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much. I'm really interested in what happens in Shreveport, so I'll be watching what goes on, and maybe we'll have it turn around. Wouldn't that be nice?
I really hope for them. They're beautiful people, and I really enjoyed learning so much from them. I do hope that things work out well for them.
Well, have a wonderful day. We're back to winter here in Northeast Ohio, so hopefully we'll have a spring coming soon and get back out on the road.
What does that mean, back to winter? See, I'm from central Minnesota.
We have had a very, very strange winter. It will be 70 one day and 28 the next, and then it'll be 60 one day and 30 the next. So today we're back to winter. We had several inches of snow, but 3 or 4 days ago it was in the 60s. There is no climate change, though. I want you to remember that, right?
I know. The climate never changes.
Of course not.
We had a nice probably 8 weeks of good winter when we usually have double that. But yeah, there's not much snow on the ground here now, which is an oddity for the beginning of March. But I'm ready. I'm ready for spring to start.
Me too. Hopefully it will be here soon. Thank you so much. I know you are off to another interview, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
All righty. Bye-bye. Chuck Marone joined me from his home in Minnesota, which is the headquarters of strongtowns.org. Always an interesting conversation. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back. I'd like to thank Chuck Marone for taking time to talk with me about the story in Shreveport, Louisiana. And always his thoughts are so interesting. He has a great perspective about what a strong town looks like. I want to remind you once again that I am looking for people to join me on the show as a guest newscaster. All you have to do is send me a message on my Facebook page or an email at outspokencyclist@gmail.com, and I'll get right back to you. I'd also like to thank Zach Paschak, the president of Detroit Bikes. I thought that was a great story. We will be back next week with a really interesting conversation with Paolo Casales, the producer of 48 Hairpin Turns at Night. It's the story of a 77-year-old man who rides down the Stelvio in Italy with no brakes and no handlebars. It is fascinating. Thanks again for listening. I hope if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.